This talk was given by Prabhu Gikan Vasan at Zen Mountain Monastery. Gikan is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. And good morning to everyone out there. My name is Gikan, and I was asked to offer the talk today. You know, in thinking about what to talk about, I really asked myself, what do I love about coming here on Sundays? Because I really do. When I was training in Fire Lotus in Brooklyn, I loved coming there on Sundays. During COVID, when I wasn't able to come here, that was rough. And once things opened up and we moved to Kingston close by, began returning, and you know, I just realized how much I loved it. And what I love about it is how many different, you know, streams of people come here, right? You know, we had a retreat for the last few days. I think it was an archery retreat. There were people here for that. Hope you guys hit your target, or however you say it. You know, we have people coming here for the first time. See, beginning instruction today. People coming here for the 100th time, the 500th time, the 1,000th time. Right? We have people who live here, people who live close by, right? And people who live out there, all of you, right? As far as the web reaches. And so I want to look at that. Right? I want to look at how people, how all of us, how we arrive here. Right? What gets us to a place like this, whether it's our first time or our, you know, whatever, 1,000th time here? What keeps us here, right? And because we think about it, you know, in all of our lives, of good decisions, bad decisions, fulfillment, regret, happiness, pain points, somehow we all arrived here. And so how does that happen? So this is from a sutra from the Pali Canon. The Pali Canon, for those who are new, is the original kind of body of teachings of the Buddha. And it's part of a much longer sutra. It's called the Sutra of Penetrative Analysis. But this is just a very small clip. And this is the Buddha speaking. What is the result of suffering? It's when someone who is overcome and overwhelmed with suffering, sorrows and wails and laments, beating their breast and falling into confusion, or it's when someone who is overcome and overwhelmed with suffering begins an external search, wondering, is there someone who might know one or two teachings to stop this suffering? I declare, the result of suffering is either confusion or a search. You know, I used to work as a clinical social worker, and in therapy, usually when meeting someone for the first time in the first session, I would usually ask, why now? What brings you to therapy now? And it's also a question that we ask at times in guardian council, right? Which is a group of seniors who meet with people who want to become formal students, right? Take that step. Why do you want to take this step now? And it's, you know, it's funny that in both guardian council and in therapy, people sometimes really struggle with this. Right, they weren't expecting to be asked. Well, I guess all you guys are expecting to be asked if you go into guardian council. But before today, people would struggle with it, right? Because they didn't know they were going to be asked. But we would press them. Right? Put it into words. Try. That will help you, but try. It's a good question for a couple of reasons. You know, first, it asks us to reflect on our history, on our karma, basically, right? Given how our histories and propensities and circumstances have led us all along, what's different about this time? About this particular time of suffering, let's say, that's actually going to bring you here, right? That's brought you here. And it also wakes us up to this moment, right? Basically, the question kind of stresses that this particular decision, right, to practice or to enter a space of healing shouldn't be, it can't be just another turning of karma. Right, those same forces that have maybe swept us along, they can't just kind of sweep us, you know, into therapy, right, or sweep us into the guardian council, right? It needs to be intentional. Okay. So, what is the result of suffering? It's when someone who is overcome and overwhelmed with suffering, sorrows and wails and laments, beating their breasts and falling into confusion. We suffer. That is a fundamental teaching of Buddhism. It's the first noble truth that the Buddha offered when he began to teach. And, you know, I'm imagining that it's probably the first truth he himself discovered when he was still a prince, right, ensconced in his castle with all the luxuries he could possibly want. And despite those luxuries, in the midst of those luxuries, he realized he was still suffering. And for those of us who are new, I want to talk a little bit about that word, suffering. The Pali word is dukkha, and it's usually translated as suffering. It can also be translated as stress or dissatisfaction. And the word dukkha derives from two other older words. When put together, they mean an ill-fitting cartwheel. Right, so you got your cart, right, the wheels. It's when, like, the spoke doesn't quite fit properly. Okay? There's also an alternate derivation that some scholars think is more accurate when put together, two words that means something that's poorly balanced. Right, so, you know, I guess back then if you had your, like, mule or whatever you used, you know, you got your big thing on your mule, if it's not properly balanced. Right? Either way, it refers to, you know, it's the connotation of being wobbly. Being unstable, right, in danger of tipping over. Okay, that's kind of the derivation of the word dukkha we translate as suffering. And I think it's important to understand this because, you know, otherwise, especially when you're starting practice, you know, it's easy to think, you know, my life is going well. You know, well, I'm not suffering, right? I don't feel myself suffering. You know, I remember in a couple of like social circles, like gatherings way back when I would talk to people who, you know, weren't practicing, and we're just talking. Oh yeah, I go to this, you know, Zen center. I practice Buddhism, and I said, oh, what's it about? I said, oh, it's about suffering. I said, well, that's good for you, but I'm not suffering. I'm like, why do you think you're suffering? You know, things are going well for you. You know, and so I think what the Buddha might say to that is, yeah, okay, that's great, but all that means is that the wheel happens to be working for now. Right? It doesn't change the fact that fundamentally that wheel is fitted wrong. Right? And so it's only a matter of time, you know, before our ride, and we're kind of cruising here, right? We got our tunes going, we got the Starbucks and the cup holder, right? We're cruising. It's going to stall or swerve, right? And we will end up in a rut or crashing. Like, I had this recurring dream. It doesn't happen a lot, but it definitely does recur, of driving and my brakes stop working. You know, so like it's always the same setting. Like it's dusk and I'm going downhill, and suddenly like my brakes stop. And in the last iteration of this, they didn't just stop; they disappeared altogether. Like I looked down, and where my brakes were, they were just like nothing. Right, so my brakes literally like vanished. Right? And all of a sudden, like in my dream, I'm just like, oh shit, like what do I do now? Like there are cars, there's like, so I'm like start like swerve, and I'm like, you know. If there are any therapists in the audience, you can give me your give me your thoughts about this later, over lunch or something. But you know, from the point of view of Buddhism, that's not just dreams, right? That's what our waking hours are like, whether we realize it or not. Right? If things are going well, it just means that our ride is good for now. Right. And it's also important to understand that, you know, that suffering doesn't just happen when the brakes fail. Right. In Buddhism, I'm not going to talk about this too much, but there's something called the three marks of existence. Okay. And one of them is suffering. Okay. And, you know, the understanding is that existence comes to be marked by suffering because we misunderstand existence. We misunderstand how things work. We misunderstand how how our perceptions, how our thoughts work. And we, therefore, we misunderstand the world around us. Therefore, when we contact the world around us, the world and we become marked with suffering, right? And that's not just when we're aware of it, right? Even when the ride is going really, really well, right? It's still marked that way, right? So I just wanted to kind of offer that to people who are maybe a little unfamiliar with that word, suffering. So how does this whole thing happen? That how's this whole, all that, how's it work? Well, in a number of the Pali Sutras, the Buddha talks about his spiritual biography. And I found this actually helpful because he actually backs it up to when he was like us. He actually starts off by saying, before my enlightenment, when I was still just an unawakened bodhisattva, right? That means he was like us, right? And I think that's a good thing. And he talks about how this happened for him. And he said, you know, being myself subject to birth, I sought what was also subject to birth. Being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, and sorrow, I sought what was also subject to aging, sickness, death, and sorrow. Okay, so when the Buddha says in that thing I quoted earlier that suffering leads to confusion or a search, this is the confusion side of it. This is how confusion gets perpetuated, right? This is the confusion that we fall into. You know, basically, you know, being wobbly, we look for other wobbly stuff to keep ourselves from being wobbly, right? Being of the nature to tip over, right? To fall. We search for other things that are of the nature to tip over and fall. Essentially, in suffering, we turn to suffering. And it's interesting that the Buddha uses the word sought. You know, I sought what was also subject to birth, right? I sought what was subject to sorrow, right? Even in our confusion, we are actively seeking, right? And the Buddha has a lot of passages, a lot of teachings, where he sort of talks about what is happening in our minds, right? That causes that, right? There is this, you know, the mind is constantly working on the world, working on itself, right? Working on different parts of ourselves. And so there is a search that's happening, but what we're seeking is just simply more suffering, even though we wouldn't necessarily frame it that way. Now, a couple of days ago, the New York Times had an analysis about the violence that's happening in the Middle East. I'm going to proceed sort of delicately, because I know this is a delicate subject for a lot of us, and there's a lot of rawness around it, different kinds of rawness, depending on how you land. But it sort of talked about how, you know, in that recent attack, where, you know, a number of children were killed, right? They belonged to the Druze community. And it said that, you know, once again, this region is teetering on the edge. And it said, this attack is exactly the kind of event that pushes leaders into irreversible escalatory cycles. Right? And I was struck by that word, irreversible. Right? It pushes them into something that's completely irreversible. Right? You know, the sutras are replete with analyses of how compulsive suffering is. Right, how when it's not recognized and not healed, suffering simply takes on a life of its own. Right, and so, you know, this article went on, and it said, you know, the on one hand, the Biden administration has once again thrown its playbook at the problem. It has sent another aircraft carrier, another squadron of fighter jets, and I'm reading this. I'm just like, this. The person who wrote it just seems exhausted as they're writing it. You know, there's this sense that, you know, there's like nothing new happening here, right? It's just, once again, here we go, right? And then on the other hand, it talked about, you know, Iran and Hezbollah and the risk that their revenge instinct would outweigh their pragmatism. Once again, that word instinct, right? This analysis was just full of these little words just on the compulsive nature of suffering. Right, that this is something that has taken on a life of its own, and it's just, you know, as far as I know, the analysis didn't really say how it could be different, right? And so it's really, really important when you enter practice to begin to understand that, right? Suffering doesn't happen only when things are bad, right? It happens, it is its own kind of machine that keeps going, right? Whether we're aware of it or not. And practice is to make ourselves aware of it. Right? So bring our awareness to that machine and all the intricate ways that it operates. You know, I've been reading a collection of plays and poetry by a writer I really like, and in the introduction it says, you know, his characters are unhappy and tragic, not because society keeps them from attaining their objects, but because they cannot fully understand what it is they want. I think the Buddha would agree with that. You know, we don't suffer because we fail to get what we want. We often do get what we want, right? That's generally a good thing. You know, I think it's possible, if we really have the means, to kind of keep replacing, you know, unhappiness with happiness, you know, until the moment of our death, right? Especially today, when reality can be augmented and modified in so many different ways, right? It's what the Buddha's parents tried to do. You know, according to legend, when he was born, it was prophesied he'd either be an ascetic or a ruler. So they surrounded him in luxury. Keep the happiness going, right? Just keep it going, right? And then, of course, our son is going to be a ruler, right? But it didn't work, and it still doesn't work. I think what's happening in the world really shows that it doesn't work, right? There's so much that can potentially be attained. Land is attainable. Resources are attainable. Retaliation is attainable. Victory is attainable. I personally very much hope that a ceasefire is attainable. None of that is going to stop suffering. So what do we do? Given all that, what do we do? Well, the Buddha continues in his kind of spiritual narrative. He said, "Then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, and sorrow, do I also seek what is subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, and sorrow? Suppose that, being myself subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, and sorrow, and understanding the danger in what's subject to all of that, what if I seek the unaging, the unailing, the deathless, and the sorrowless?" How do we turn all this? How do we turn the tide of our karma? What? How do we get from a life of confusion, an active seeking of confusion, to a different kind of life? Right? We start by understanding the danger. In the sutras, there's often a very concise teaching that's presented that's called gratification, danger, and escape. And the Buddha says, the first thing we need to do is we need to understand the gratification behind suffering. We need to understand it's, you know, it does gratify us, right? It does, right? You know, the things that make us suffer, they do give us a moment of pleasure. Otherwise, we simply wouldn't do them, right? In some ways, that's what hooks us. We need to understand that. Then we need to understand the danger, right? We need to be able to see both the manifestation of the danger, that is the mess that we cause, that are caused to us, etc., but also the internal danger, right? That it's based upon faulty assumptions, right, about our relationship with the world and how the nature of the world and the nature of us, right? I remember years ago in one of the clinics I worked at, I ran an anger management group where, you know, most of the people were like court mandated. You know, they go through the anger management thing to get their certificate. And there was this one young gentleman, I'll call him Corey, and he didn't give a rat's ass about anger management. He pretty much said, he was a really sweet guy. I mean, he was a nice guy, right? And who did some bad stuff. And he just said, "I just want the certificate, doc." You know, it's like, come on, like, you know, let's get real here. And, you know, he had his hustles going and he would brag about them, you know, how he was getting away with this, getting away with that, you know, after he said, after anger management, I'm just going to go and, you know, do my thing, right? Whatever shady deals he was doing, he was going to go and do them. And I was feeling down about it. And so there's one time, you know, after, you know, I was clearing up the group room and this other guy, this older gentleman, Bill, who really had been through the ringer. He was an older gentleman. He had served long stretches of jail time on multiple occasions. And, you know, he was actually really committed to being in anger management, right? He really wanted to learn this stuff. And he came over to me and he said, you know, Corey's got you down. I said, yeah, he does got me down. Like, you know, he doesn't want to do any of this. He said, don't worry about it. He said, you know, he's still young. You know, he's not seeing where his life is going to go yet. But he thinks he's immortal. He thinks he can get away with this forever. Like, just give him time. You know, he'll come around. You know, at that time, he didn't see the danger. He saw the gratification, right? He loved the gratification, right? But he didn't see the danger yet. Right? So having been sort of mesmerized by the gratification and understanding that, having seen the danger that it causes us and around us, we then turn to looking for the escape. It's when someone who is overcome and overwhelmed with suffering begins an external search, wondering, is there someone who might know one or two teachings to stop the suffering? You know, the scholar Paul Harrison, he studied some of the early sutras, early Mahayana sutras, where the notion of a bodhisattva was just being formed, right? And he identified four key stages in the biography of a bodhisattva, the first of which he calls the arising of the thought of awakening, right? We might refer to that as bodhicitta. That might be a phrase that some of you are familiar with. We sometimes use the phrase raising the bodhi mind, right? That's how we turn this. That's how we begin to turn this. That's that pivotal moment, right? When the Buddha says suffering can either go to confusion or a search, that's the pivotal moment. That's what's going to determine how our life is going to proceed, right? And I love that phrase, raising the Bodhi mind, because, you know, it just gives me the image of just being sort of almost drowning in the torrent of our life and circumstances. And then we just kind of just like, you know, pop our head out of the water, right? Or pop a little periscope out of the water. Just look around and say, oh, wait a minute. You know, it doesn't have to be this way. Right? I'm not quite sure how it wouldn't be this way, but it doesn't have to be this way. Right? There's something else, right? Potentially there's something else here. And it's important, I think, that it says here, begins an external search. I thought that was curious when I read that. And I actually looked at another translation, and it said to search outside. We search outside. And I was curious because, you know, so much of practice is so internal. In fact, we say in Zen, don't look outside yourself. Right? But experientially, you know, it does make sense. Right? Because when we get to that point, we sort of have kind of reached the limit, I think, of what we can do on our own. You know, I remember when I arrived for beginning instruction way, way back. This is way before Fire Lotus, right? We had like a loft space in West Manhattan. And so, you know, I get off the train, you know, I looked up, but this is, I'm totally dating myself, but I actually looked in the phone book under churches-Buddhism, right? I left messages for like three places. This place was the only place that got back to me and told me what to do. So I said, all right, I'll go with this place. And so, you know, I get off the train. There's a building, right? I actually kind of walked around the block a few times, right? Kind of like circumambulating the building. What I was basically asking myself is, okay, like, am I really ready to do this here? Right? Have I really kind of done, you know, is this, you know, am I at the point now where I have to ask for help? Right? A part of this was realizing that, you know, okay, well, if I go in here for beginning instruction and start practicing Buddhism and that doesn't work, right, then I'm like really screwed, right? Because then it's kind of like, then we don't know what to do. But have I really kind of exhausted myself? And yeah, I did. I was exhausted. So I went up, right? So in some ways, you know, in order to enter this practice of not looking outside ourselves, we need to start by looking outside of ourself, of our inner drives, right? We need to see that we need help. And so we ask, I think, each in our own way, is there someone who might know one or two teachings to stop this suffering? What strikes me about that is how humble it is. You know, when the Buddha offered this, he didn't say, you know, we seek enlightenment, we seek a teacher that's going to help us see the nature of the self. You know, we seek a teacher that's going to cut off the cycles of rebirth, that's nirvana. None of that. There's someone who might know one or two teachings to stop this suffering. You know, I'm thinking about all the people I've seen in therapy, and, you know, how, and people enter with all sorts of reasons, right? Some of them are really big, right? I want to self-actualize this, that, you know, but I help them to break it down. And oftentimes it's very humble, you know, I want to stop being depressed. My kids got taken away. I want to get them back, right? My life is just careening out of control, right? I got to get a handle on it, doc, right? And I think that happens here as well. We have a lot of words here, right? Enlightenment, liberation, right? I think what sets us off on the path are not those words, right? There's something that's much more pressing in some ways than that, right? Much more immediately pressing, right, to the actual day-to-day experience of us living our lives in the world and in our own skins. I declare, the result of suffering is either confusion or a search. You know, when I was working with kids, which I actually really enjoy doing, when you work with kids in therapy, you realize how boring adults are, right? Because kids are just so much more fun in therapy, right? So when I used to work with kids, the one thing I would found really helpful was to have broken games in my office. Right? Like I had a chess set where like five of the pieces were missing, right? Or do you guys know that game Connect Four? It's like this vertical tic-tac-toe thing where you set up the structure and you have to drop these chips in. I had one and it wouldn't stay upright. Like it was just broken to the point where, you know, once you start playing, it would just like fall to pieces on you, right? And so, you know, some of the newer therapists couldn't understand that, right? In fact, I had one intern who offered to like buy me a new Connect Four because she was so like disturbed that I would do this. I don't want a new Connect Four, I said. We have a new one in the play closet. I don't use it. I want this one. And she asked why, and I said, because you get to see what the kids do, right? You know, and you know, you get to see the boy, you know, who has like attentional disorders, painstakingly try to put that thing together with scotch tape, right? Or you see the kid that you know, just basically takes the pieces, throws them all over my room, and just starts crying, right? Or like this one rather precocious girl, she brought a Connect Four from her house and brought it to my office so that we could, in her words, have a proper game of Connect Four. Right? Yeah, that's what you get to see, right? That's what practice asks us to do. Right? That's what we're asked to do here, right? Whatever we're playing at, whatever game we've set up, what happens when it falls to pieces and the parts are just scattered across the floor, right? Whatever rules we live our life by, because they've gotten us places that we like, and we assume that everyone is playing the same game and they're all following the same rules, what happens when we encounter a person or a situation or a geopolitical event that doesn't follow those same rules, that breaks the rules? What do we do in that moment, right? Look at it. Study it, right? In that moment, right, we can turn our life, right? We can turn it to what maybe we've always done that maybe has led us to confusion, or we can turn it to practice, right, towards a search, wherever we happen to be in that. So, in another couple of weeks, we're going to be starting Ango, our fall training period. And I just want to be the first person to sort of publicly, in a talk, congratulate Taisho Sands. Taisho, wherever you are, who is going to be the new Shuso, the chief disciple, the chief student for this fall training period, who will be leading us with her years of just wonderful, wonderful practice. Taisho, I cannot wait to see you sitting there in white. You're going to be beautiful at this, wherever you are. So we'll have immense opportunities in the fall to turn our practice, right? To turn our minds to practice, right? To turn our minds to searching wherever we happen to be. This is our first time. This is our millionth time, right? Let's really take this up, Right? Let's take this up and let's really use everything at our disposal in order to really search. In order to search. Okay. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.